What a day. I'm always thrilled to have a lot of people on the show, especially when it's celebrating something like a new release. So we're going to jump right into it because we know by now many of you are drooling over the new publication that's been released by Star Trek Adventures Modiphius. I'm Michael Dismuke. I am a blogger on Continuing Missions, which is the number one blog site for Star Trek Adventures and Captain's Log RPG. I'm also a freelance writer for Star Trek Adventures RPG and lead writer on Captain's Log. And of course, one of my favorite things to do every week is to co-host this show, Continuing Conversations, with Jim Johnson.
Hey everybody, Jim Johnson. I am the project manager and line editor for the Star Trek Adventures RPG and the Captain's Log solo RPG, both published by Modiphius Entertainment, and co-host on this here show with Michael for well over 100 episodes now, moving on toward 120. Hard to believe. Working through year three now. Gosh, who thought that would happen? And really very excited to have this this group of people with us tonight. So I'll just jump right into it, and I'll just work my way around the screen here. So we're going to do quick introductions. I think you all have been on the show at least once, so we can skip the the newbie questions. Just go right to introduce yourself, talk a little bit about what you did on the book, and then if you've got anything new and cool to plug briefly, I will do that, and then we'll carry it on. So I will first
what start book off- you didn't even announce what book yet, Jim.
What?
You didn't even announce the book yet.
Oh, well, we're talking about the brand new Star Trek Adventures supplement called the Federation Klingon War Tactical Campaign. So without more ado, let me kick it over to the lead writer on this one to introduce himself, Al Spader.
How's it going? I'm Al Spader. I'm a freelance writer, contributing author for Star Trek Adventures. I'm also a system designer. I helped design the overlay in the tactical campaign. So I'm excited to actually get a chance to talk about this now.
Good. And just so you all know, I'm going to be handing over the baton of guest host to Al today because I want to make sure he knows more of the nuances of the book than I do, since he was the lead writer. And I want to make sure he asks all the right questions to pull out all the right gems and Easter eggs for y'all today. So thank you, Al, for taking that baton.
Thank you. I'll try to do y'all proud.
Give myself off mute. Thanks, Al. Appreciate it. And we'll go next to Michael Duxbury.
Hi there. Thanks for having me back. As you say, I'm Michael Duxbury. I'm a freelance writer on Star Trek and other Modiphius properties, as well as for companies like Cubicle 7 and the Warhammer RPGs and self-publishing at Seal of Sabad. I did a bunch of different things for this book, including some mission briefs, the final adventure of the campaign, Dying of the Light, and the trauma system, which I think we'll be talking about some more, along with various topics and wartime roles. I did a little bit of pieces of chipping in where I could. Right now, I guess I'm plugging a Kickstarter that I'm doing. I'm not sure if it will be over by the time this goes live, but I'm currently, for Zine Month, doing a Kickstarter for the Me, the Singularity RPG, which is a haunted house in space game.
Cool. Very cool. Welcome back. And thanks for all the hard work you did on this one. And now you haunted house in space. I'm going to have to go check out that Kickstarter.
Please.
Cool. I'll have to make a note to remember that. All right. Thanks, Michael. And then we'll move over to John Kennedy. Introduce yourself, please.
So I've been working on this line since pretty much the beginning. I am a freelancer for Modiphius, and also I work for Renegade Game Studios and a bunch of other companies. And I worked on bringing some of the more obscure species into the light for this one, doing a deep dive into Star Trek, and then also working on a lot of like the historical events leading up to it. And I'm blanking on my own little mission brief. The battle at Corvin 2 doesn't sound like that's its name, but I'll get the name right by the time we get up to me. But which was also just a lot of fun because I love talking about Klingons. I love it when Klingons get to be sneaky.
Awesome. Thank you. And then last but not least, Allison Saib, tell us a little bit about yourself and welcome to the show again.
Hi, I'm Allison. I freelance write for Star Trek Adventures and a couple other Modiphius properties. done Dreams Machines, done a little bit on several others whose names escape me at the moment. Worked with Al on Sentience, which is also under the 2D20 system. Check it out. Do a little bit of work here and there for Paizo, for Mongoose, and like a bunch of other companies. For Star Trek Adventures, I've done quite a lot. Worked on Captain's Log, which was so much fun. Worked on Lower Decks, and for Klingon War, I have done a little adventure, which people will be emerging into in the later parts of the campaign, as well as some wartime characters, traits, values, focuses, events, and a little bit on the safety mechanics. So, yeah, there we go.
All right. Well, I guess we're going to get things started. Thank you all for being here. This is really exciting to have so many writers in one place, and seeing you each face-to-face is really, really exciting. So, Jim, why don't you start us off by talking a little bit about what the tactical campaign is, how it came to fruition, and where this all came from?
Yeah, sure. So now we've been developing this book for almost 2 years now, a little over 2 years. And so I have to put the Wayback Machine on to 2021, I think, is when the leadership at Modiphius and I were kicking this around, like what was next for the line at the time. And we knew we wanted to do a follow-on book from the Discovery campaign guide, and we thought about what would that look like. And we knew that at the time, one of the things that we hadn't really had a chance to do yet in the line was to do like an Admiralty level type of campaign. And like we touched on it in the Command Source book, where, you know, players could be the admirals and do stuff, but we wanted to really take that to the next level and like give players an opportunity to do like the RP stuff within a campaign or within a mission, but also to take a bigger scope to a war and have, like have an opportunity to mess with assets and resources and to attempt little side missions that would benefit them in the RP sessions or whatever. And we were just like, you know, kicking ideas around, and this morphed a lot along the way. And of course, you know, I brought you on board as lead writer, because at the time I had three other major projects on my plate, and there was just no way I could do all four of them at the same time. It was Captain's Log and this one, and then a couple other books. And that's why I reached out to you and to Michael, because like I can't do this alone. I need help. And I knew you, Al, especially, were really mechanical focused, and I thought this would be a really good fit for you. And you know, obviously it worked out. But as far as like why is this in the game line now, it's because it was an opportunity to explore parts of the franchise that we hadn't really got to in a great deal of detail. And when you think about Star Trek as a franchise, right, there's a lot of moments in the timeline where wars do flare up, and they have a really significant impact on the franchise and on the characters, right? And of course, the RPG being a super focus on characters, we wanted to bring that element in. So like, you know, when you think about like the Romulan War in the 22nd century, and then all the spark ups with the Klingons, you've got the Dominion War. There's just some big ticket item things that as a gamer, I want to know, like, hey, my character joined Starfleet to be a scientist, but now they're thrust into a war. How is that going to impact them? Like, it doesn't just happen. You don't fight the war and you're like, okay, now I'm back off to this other thing. I'm back to being a scientist now. It's all nice and simple. It's like, no way. No, no, no. There is no way that's simple. And I mean, we see that in real life, obviously, like with all the wars that we've had. There is real significant impacts to people. And like, even in the Enlightened Federation, people are still people. And the horrible things that happen during a war is going to have an impact on you. And I know that, you know, in my history as a Star Trek gamer, like I always really loved the post Dominion War period of time to set my games, because we had that wealth of stuff from the Dominion War that would inform the characters and inform the storylines. So even if it wasn't a focus, like the characters had it in their backstory, they were impacted by the war. They may have, you know, prosthetics or just things in their mind that impacted them, right? So I really wanted that piece of it to be added to the game line, and we just decided to focus on the Federation Klingon War, because it was fresh in our minds, because we just watched, you know, the first couple seasons of Discovery. And I think especially what we're going to be talking about today, is I think a lot of this stuff would port very easily over to any era of Star Trek. So if you want to do Dominion War, all this stuff will come right along with you and make use of it. So I think that's the context, kind of what where we wanted this product to be, was to be more options, more rules, but all kind of focused on that wartime thing, where it's certainly not the focus of the franchise, but this stuff happens. And we wanted to make sure that we acknowledge that and give it as more tools and more opportunities for players and game masters to just add that element if they want to into their games.
And like all of our books, the direction that we decided to go when we were creating the outline was we wanted to make this book useful for everyone, right? We've got stuff in here for the players, we've got stuff in here for the GMs, and so on and so forth. So you'll see lots of stuff throughout that we're going to draw parallels to that people can use and whatnot. But we're going to start with chapter one, which is all about player options. So as we like to do, we were looking at the timeline of the Klingon War, and we kind of started imagining what did the Federation look like at this time that maybe wasn't necessarily on screen in Discovery, but we know that we have TOS, we have Strange New Worlds, we've got the movie era, and so John got very excited about trying to pull out some of these unique species that we see, especially like in the backgrounds during a lot of the movies and things like that. So we start right off with six new species that players can choose. We have the Enar, the Arcadians, the Arealo. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but that's how I'll say it. The Betelgeusans, the Corridonites, and the Megarites. So, John, where did you come up with these, and what went into the thinking when you were designing them?
Well, they're completely original, purely from my brain, and totally not from the background costumes for some scenes from the movies. So a lot of these get mentioned a lot. We see them in the background, but they're kind of those species, with the exception of the Enar, that if you had mentioned, the Betelgeusians, you've heard of the star, you heard them mention the star base in the series, but you don't really see them a whole lot, or at least you don't think you do, because no one is walking through a crowd and goes, oh, there's an Areolo over there. It's always something in the background. But it's always so interesting, because when these, when I was researching these, there's a lot of in-depth lore, both in the primary canon and also in the secondary canon. And they're just all really interesting. I like centaurs, and so the Areolo were just very interesting to tackle, because it makes you think, how does a quadruped species function on Starship? I know in the new movies, we saw Kevin, who's that little tiny alien who likes to roll around. But a lot of these species, they have unique needs, or they're just very interesting in what they want to do. Like the Arcadians they love to explore, but they are completely pacifistic, and they'll even refuse to fire a phaser at someone if they believe there's a better way, which they usually believe there's a better way. And like the Areolo, they're just dedicated to art and sciences. They draw upon a lot of the traditional centaur myth, where they were teachers, and they're warriors too. But it's just I'm looking at the picture in the book right now, and I kind of love how, he looks a little grumpy, which, Michael's holding up the picture right now. But it's really just all these extreme species, but they're also unique and detailed. And then also there's the Enar, who I love Andorians. I love the Enar, and people who are fans of the series, you've seen the Enar before. They were big in Enterprise. And then, was it Hemmer, the engineer on Stranger Worlds? We got a really wonderful story arc with him. And so I'm really glad that we're putting them in the book, so that players, if they want to play one, now they can.
Allison, Michael, what did you think when you saw the species that were on the list to be put into this book?
I love the Betelgeusians. The design, the aesthetic for them, totally clicks with me. Arcadians just have that sheer potential to be so much fun to play as well, I think.
I was so thrilled with it, just because that Areola species is so cool. And I have questions about the art, and I'll probably have to, before when we get a little bit more in depth about the art in this book, I'll ask Jim about who the artist was on here. Because John, did you have to reference, like, I'm looking at like the areola, its feet, its legs, like, was that made up or was that somewhere in canon, their physiology?
So one of the things with what we work with is that we try to work like the primary canon as much as possible. And we respect the secondary canon. And for people who are new to this, that's the stuff that came out in like the hundreds of books, manuals and everything in like the 50-year existence of Trek. But it's stuff that's not exactly addressed in the show. And we try to work with primary as much as possible. But you do see the Areolo in the background scenes, like in the motion picture and also in some of the other episodes. So and the feet, it's really difficult to kind of capture because when you see the species, it's from the waist up. But I love the fact that they're we could draw upon a little bit of the secondary canon. And you look at its feet, and for the people at home, it's not a hoof like a horse would. It's kind of like a very muscular like paw that they run on as capably as a horse would on hoofs. And it's really cool. Like I've got an anthropology background, like just imagining how the species would function. Like, you know, I know we don't have centaurs in real life, you know, but it's interesting to think about, oh, well, now it's on a spaceship. That's a confined space. How does a really tall species with broad shoulders, how does it use a turbo lift? How does it go up? How does it work on the bridge? In Star Trek, you know, they try to be as inclusive as possible, but you've still got species that are huge that are sort of like, you know, forced to try to type on a keyboard that's clearly designed for humans. And I acknowledge that that's a practical thing. You know, you've got to make a set for us human actors. But it's really cool.
Yeah, fortunately, he'll never have to scrub out Jeffrey's tube. So good for him.
That is true.
That's what did you think when you saw this list?
Did you say for me? Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. yeah, it's one of those things where I was going down the list and, you know, mostly not species that I was that familiar with. And similar to what John has just described, it was a really inspiring thing once we saw the finished product and saw the art that had been produced for each of these species. And it really does bring to life the potential to kind of take those characters and explore some of those strange interactions that John was talking about in how your group is going to cater to the accessibility needs of characters who might otherwise not be expected to be part of the usual Starfleet Federation story. So yeah, that was really exciting.
Awesome. Yeah. I do want to dig Jim right into the art real quick. Cause I wanted to get your opinion on something. Cause I noticed something as I was going through, looking at all the different, art, for the first few chapters, was there a decision, a directive that you gave the artist to like start, including all body sizes and shapes? I noticed that this was in the Lower Decks campaign guide as well. We didn't just have like your jacked, perfectly fit, you know, Starfleet officer. Like, it seems like we're starting to include bodies of all shapes and sizes. And I was wondering if that was part a decision that you made, or was that an aerial choice?
No, it was. I mean, not to be immodest, right? It was 100% on me. And Ariel and I have been working together now for almost 4 years now, since the Shackleton book. And he and I are both on the same wavelength, and we both agreed that we really wanted to expand the artwork and expand the scope of what's possible and really be intentional about making the art be more representative of people, right? Like genders, body shapes, everything. And I think you're seeing that reflected now in the artwork, where especially with the Lower Decks and the animated series supplement and this one, and even the Discovery supplement that came out a couple of years ago, because he was the AD on that, you're seeing much even more diversity of species and body types within those species. Because you're right, like if you watch the shows, not everybody is Hollywood perfect, jacked up and what like what you're saying, and there are different body shapes and styles and just things, and it's like it's representative. Like you just go walk down the street in your local city or town or something, you'll see all kinds of body shapes and colors and everything else. And we wanted to reflect that in Star Trek, of course, because it's diversity, right? It's diversity in action. So we've been really intentional, very much, and not just in the character cutouts like what you're seeing for the character species, but actually within the half page illustrations as well. You're seeing more diversity in those, and you'll continue to see that in our other upcoming products. You'll see even more diversity as we go. And I just want to say, like, I loved that we decided on these six, because as a longtime Star Trek fan, like I remember back in the day, always freeze framing on Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 4 and Star Trek 6, like all the background shots of especially the Federation Council meetings, like where Sarek is arguing with the Klingon ambassador or whatever, all those little random aliens that are in the background that you don't really know much about, but Last Unicorn Games and FASA, and even there was a book called The Worlds of the Federation, which was a silver cover book that just, you know, showed pictures of all these weird random aliens that we didn't know anything about. But it's like, oh, what's their story? What are they about? And I think my favorite one in here is probably the Arcadians, because like they're just a background character with like these big gigantic heads. And it's like, oh, what's their story? They're kind of like China dolls almost in some respects. And I'm just excited that we're able to do these deep cuts and that John was able to pull in some really cool details for these species and add, you know, six more crazy, interesting species to the mix. And it's just, you know, if you pair this up with all the other recent products we've done, I mean, we must have released, what, 20 odd new species in the last couple of years. And that's just expanding the scope beyond your traditional, you know, human Klingon Trill Vulcan kind of thing that everybody has done in the past. So hopefully people are excited about the possibilities. And especially, like, I really am vibing off of the Areolo. Because like we got centaurs in the game now. Like, how can you not want the centaur? And I think about what Scott Pearson did with the Kofuari in the Shackleton book, right? So you got little weasel dudes, and then you got the big old centaurs. And it's like, why not have a Starfleet ship crew full of non-humans? So like, that would be so neat to see visually now, right? So it's great to see this just from a gamer perspective, seeing the deep cuts that we're able to start adding into the game now for species.
Yeah, thank you for that, Jim. So if we go from there, from your six species, and then we start talking about wartime characters, because characters are different during a war than when they are just doing their normal routine. So Allison had the opportunity to go in and do a bunch of different traits that we'll talk about, like things that are personally happening to individuals. How might your focuses be different if you're creating a new character specifically for a war? There's some career events in here, lots of really cool stuff. So Allison, you want to talk about what were you thinking when you were putting this together, and what were you trying to encapsulate by including this in the book?
Yeah, sure. First I'll cough, and then I'll tell you that the main thing I wanted to consider was the way that the war and kind of being thrown into a military conflict changes people, and that's something that I wanted to capture. In the broader universe of Star Trek, nobody wants to grow up to be a soldier. It's not something which is typically seen in like Federation cultures to be something to be seen as particularly like heroic or noble. It's something which is seen as you're put into a war and the Federation is often on a defensive position. Any conflicts tend to have to be motivated by humanitarian needs, and as a result, the war changes people from soldiers into from who they are into soldiers. It's a position that you're thrust into. Innocent people become victims, that kind of thing. And sometimes the kindest people have to take deplorable actions for the greater good. So in order to reflect that, I wanted to come up with a series of traits for characters who can to represent how they adapt to the changing times. Whether they're acting to stop the conflict by means of meeting it head on, kind of with force, in which case they might be more militaristic. They might join a militia. They might seek to crush this horrible enemy. Be they Romulan, be they Klingon, whoever it is that's trying to hurt you and the people closest to you. or whether you're emphasizing yourself as a diplomat. You're trying to reach out to this unknown people and resolve the underlying conflict. Whatever it is, it just kind of like it changes how your character would view the universe. So I wanted to put together some traits to reflect that. And we have some which I think came across quite well. I don't want to go into too much like spoiler territory, because obviously we wanted people to read the book. So we have done a couple of tweaks on how diplomats work, because obviously diplomacy works different in times of conflict. Militia is a new trait, which is you're not enlisted in Starfleet. Your species might not even be a member of the Federation, but you fight alongside them. You have nonviolent resistors, so people who obviously are resisting the war in a nonviolent way. You are like thrown into this as a conflict. You need to figure out how to approach it. And a lot of the traits are about the challenge of how you kind of view and personalize your role in the conflict. Opportunists. That's a new trait. The Federation doesn't permit its members to make use of war for its own ends, you know, war profiteers, that kind of thing. Your character might wind up doing something like that. How do you like pass that in your morality, that kind of thing?
Allison, can I pause right there for a second? Yeah. So I'm wondering, like, a lot of us are game masters. What might you do if you see that someone on your crew has a prisoner of war trait? Michael Dismuke, if I had the prisoner of war trait, what might be something you do as a GM to kind of accentuate that if you're going, maybe this might be post-war time. Maybe I've just got rescued or something like that.
Honestly, the first thing I have to say is I think this is the first Star Trek Adventures publication that has added a chapter about traits. Correct me if I'm wrong, and this is a big deal to me, and I love it because I know in our game we're really exploring traits. I know we mentioned traits in other books and talk about traits, but this is the first time it's like, here are new traits you can put on your character and what they mean. So I really love, Allison, what you're describing here. As I look at these, like prisoner of war, you said, Al, how would I use that? It may be that once captured, you know, sometimes away teams gets captured, I might use this as a negative trait so that maybe this character is having a harder time being captured. Maybe they're having flashbacks. Maybe we actually do a little bit of career event talk in the prison cell to develop the character even more, to make us empathetic toward the character. But again, traits can be used both positively and negatively. So maybe the character, after getting shaken up by being captured, maybe they flip it and turn that trait into a positive, like, well, I actually know how to escape prisons. I was a prisoner of war on this and this and this time. So I love this as a storytelling module that really allows you to explore characters. I think this is one of the best chapters I've seen in a long time because it's new and it's giving me a lot of ideas.
Yeah, I just want to note, Modiphius in some of the other game lines, especially some of the newer games that are coming out based on the 2D20 system, they're trying to lean even more into traits or truths, or there's another term for them. Fallout uses a different term for them. I don't remember off the top of my head, but like the concept of a trait being a thing that is true or not true, right? For the purposes of the character or the scene or the location or the equipment or whatever. And so, clearly having this in this book is great because it's giving Star Trek Adventures an opportunity to lean into traits even more. I think Nathan Dowdell, who designed the system originally, he acknowledged that we didn't push traits hard enough in the core rulebook, and we wanted to continue to show just how flexible and powerful they can be. Like, I mean, certainly species traits are awesome because everything that's special about a species can be encapsulated in that single word, right? Everything that's cool about Vulcans, well, you have the Vulcan trait, so everything that is important about Vulcans is there. So I just love that we're able to add more depth and detail to traits that, even though they don't have a specific mechanical benefit other than, you know, sometimes being an advantage or a detriment, there's just more detail here. And I think it just really shows you the flexibility of the system about what's possible. Just really think about the traits and what you're giving to your characters. So I really appreciate that this was able to be added to the book. And I think y'all did a great job on this. I love it. good stuff.
And then there's a whole list of values here that Allison put in. Like, there's a lot of new players are always asking, how do I come up with a value? Well, there's about 20 in here that you can look at, and you can either use those directly or adapt them to be your own. I think that we're going to see these values come into play in a few minutes when we get to Michael Duxbury's section on the trauma of war. But Allison, one last thing before we get out of here and move to the next section. I saw your wartime focuses. So we talk a lot about focuses in the game.
That's my favorite, of course.
You know, there's a lot of like standard, basic, you know, scientific, diplomatic ones that are offered. How much fun did you have developing this list of focuses that are focused more on wartime?
A lot of fun. Wanted to come up with as many of them as possible, and ones that are useful in wartime campaign kind of a thing. Elements that characters would bring over, like what would be their focus before war, how would those have changed into this one? And these are focuses that they can take into a post-war setting as well. So I've tried to kind of get a good mix of them already for them. And one of the ways we did it, we have like a little table in the book where they are divided into like the command, con, security, engineer, science, medicine. You can roll on a D20 and just get one of them. Get one of them at random while you're making your character. So if you don't want to like worry about which ones to choose, you've got a table there you can roll on as well.
I gotta say, when I saw impact distribution on starship bulkheads, I was like, yes, I need to make one. I want here. Like, this needs to happen. So well done there, Allison. That was pretty awesome. I'm excited to see these in action for sure.
One non sequitur here, Al. We were developing this book at the same time we were developing Captain's Log. And I knew there was an opportunity to get some random. I know you love random tables, and so I'm super just reviewing the book now. It's like, oh yeah, we got a lot of random tables into this first chapter, and Michael, I can easily see how you can use these in Captain's Log with very little difficulty, right? Like if you need a different species, I made sure to put in a species table for to add in these new species. So like if you want to add that to Captain's Log and you want even more options for your species, use that table. And then even the focuses table that Allison came up with, and some of the other tables in here, this was an opportunity to look at two different products at the same time and say we can do a lot of cross-pollinating between the two and make it even more useful. So you've been wearing me down over the last couple of years about the value of random tables, and I'm starting to embrace them more. So
we'll same page is another random table for new career events based around war that Allison got in here as well. So if you, again, you want war to be a part of your character's backstory, and it doesn't necessarily just need to be the Klingon War, right? These are some things like, you were emergency responder, you were behind enemy lines. Like, those are very cool career events. Yeah, Allison, go ahead.
Six brand new career events, six of them to choose from. Going back to wartime focuses, low and zero gravity hand-to-hand combat.
Yep.
I'm just saying. It's in there. Low and zero gravity hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, I love that because we actually see that in Discovery. In fact, that's part of the initial thing that sets off the war, right?
I know, right?
So that's fantastic. Like, excellent job on these. I think players are going to have a lot of fun going through these and adding them to a new character. Anybody else, anything to add on focuses, traits, talent, or random career events?
Only that I'm adding new characters to our starship as we speak, Al. I mean, we have a crew manifest. I'm writing down like, oh, these, I'm going to have to have some NPCs with all of this just in case my players don't pick it up.
Yeah. Like the moment I wrote low and zero gravity hand-to-hand combat, I just thought I have to have a character who has that as a focus.
So the next section we talk about is a list of talents that you can take that are more tactically focused or diplomatically focused. Basically, I went through a lot of the other 2d20 lines and said, hey, what type of warlike talents or like combat talents or diplomatic talents are out there that have been developed for other lines? Like, you know, Dune has a lot of stuff that is about diplomacy and hand-to-hand combat. And Fallout has a bunch of stuff too. Octoon had a few things. So I was able to take some in and adapt them to with a Star Trek lens. So I think there's like 12 or 13 new talents on here that you can also take when you're building a character. My favorite of which is Combat Gunner, by the way. You could, you know, ride on the back of an Argo and be really good with the gun and things like that. So, like, there's lots of cool stuff in here. If you are into, you know, tactical combat scenarios, there's a lot in here for you. And if you are a diplomat and you like talking with people, there's like four or five talents in here that will help with that as well. Yeah, like even like rousing speaker, where you can like find a group of civilians and try to get them to fight for the cause, you know, things like that. So I was excited to go through and kind of adapt a bunch of those. And I created a few of them as well. To have in our game, especially during wartime. So plenty there to choose from. And then the next section is all about roles. So if you remember back to the player's guide, we took all of the key roles on the bridge of a starship and we kind of broke them down. We talked about what they do and we gave like some quick builds for them and things like that. Well, there are other roles in the game as well. That came out of the player's guide. We had a lot of civilian roles. Out of the operations guide, we had roles on tactical squads. I was able to get some space in here to actually go into each of those roles with a little bit more detail than has been done before. So, you know, half a page to a page for each of them, explaining what they do, how to use their role ability, giving a quick build, and so on and so forth. So like the admiral role from the command division, we got in there, the ambassador, and so on and so forth. Lots of really cool roles in here. Combat engineer, which is one that I'm just dying to try at some point. Lots of details on roles that appeared in other places that weren't in the core rulebook that are specifically utilized during wartime. So
I like the fact that you can use these two for you, whoever the antagonist is in the game. So I know in our game, we play a very political game, a very very galactic political game. And so like political liaison is something that we'll be hitting a lot on. We honestly have more stress with our diplomatic efforts than we do with our ship-to-ship battle, just because of the kind of games we have. And so I think this one is really good if you want to play that DS9 level type of characters. This will help generate a lot of those.
Mm-hmm. I got two comments. Yep. So Al, I appreciate that not only did you have the opportunity to expand on the roles that were highlighted in like the player's guide, but you also added more detail about the existing roles, like the handful of roles that are in the core rule book. You added several paragraphs for each of those as well, just to add more nuance and more detail, you know, focused on a wartime experience. So I think, you know, players looking at the core rule book, wanting to have more meat to think about for their particular roles, we'll find benefits here. And then the other thing I really appreciate, how this all came together is like, you could take like chapter one about all these, the new character species, the talents, the roles, et cetera. And the wartime stuff we're about to get to with the trauma rules that Michael worked on. All of this can be lifted wholesale right out of the Federation Klingon War era and put literally anywhere else. You could use all this exactly as is, right into the Dominion War, to the Romulan War, to something else, because we collectively, you all wrote it in such a way that it's universal Star Trek, right? It's not just focused on the Federation Klingon War. And I just want to remind gamers that this is just another one of those STA books where you got to look beyond the cover. It's not just Discovery, it's everything Star Trek. And like, you could take this entire, I mean, not just this chapter, and we'll be talking about the tactical campaign later, but you could take this whole 40 pages of stuff and put it literally anywhere in Star Trek and it'll work. All this stuff will work. So look beyond the veneer, look beyond the artwork, because it's not just Discovery, it's everything Star Trek. So we like to be subversive like that.
And that section's called Roles Transform. I think Michael Duxbury, you did almost all
that. That was me. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
So what were you thinking when you were writing up these things? Like, just give us your perspective on looking at the roles as we know them currently and then how they changed during war.
Yeah, Alison obviously mentioned earlier about how, and Jim did at the start as well, that what is expected of a Starfleet officer is very different during times of war than it is in business as usual. It's not the kind of thing that Starfleet officers or people who aspire to be Starfleet officers usually sign up for. So there's a lot in there about how to reconcile the expectations of what they thought they'd be working on with the practicalities of what they're being asked to do, which is often very unpleasant. It's often turning the skills and technology that they hoped that it would be using in pursuit of peace as something to do the opposite of that, which is a it's a moment for introspection and a moment for dark themes to emerge, all of which we see in the TV series, which is always the starting point for inspiring what we wanted to include here. So yeah, it was just a little bit touching on each one, addressing both the practicalities of how this person can help in a war, because that's more obvious for some characters than it is for others. But everyone does have a part to play. And then making sure we're also leaving space not just to talk about the practicalities, but to talk about the roleplay implications, because that's what people are most interested in knowing, like, how is this going to affect my character and how can this affect the arc that my character is going to be going on over the course of the campaign.
Love it. Love it. And then we move into weapons and gear, and really it's just different uses for weapons that already exist that might be extreme uses during war. Aaron Pollier did that section, and he has some pretty terrifying uses for torpedoes in here. Mm-hmm. That I was having, that I was laughing at when he submitted them. It's a pretty good section. And then that leads us into the final section, which we're going to hand off to Michael Duxbury in just a second. I do want to say that we had this weird thing happen, right, where we were developing this book. And in fact, I think it was almost completely done before Strange New Worlds even hit streaming. And never mind Strange New Worlds season 2, where we get to see literally this next section that we're about to talk about on screen. Michael, when I saw that on Strange New Worlds, I'm like, this is like exactly what Michael Duxbury wrote about. So this was probably the first thing that I saw for this book, and this like set my brain to the direction that we wanted to go with this book. So I thank you for that, Michael. Let's talk about the trauma of war.
Thank you. That's very kind. I'm glad that it was inspirational. Certainly when I came on board and was seeing what had already been written, it had a similar effect on me. So that worked together very well. So as has been discussed multiple times, what's significant about role-playing in a time of war is the psychological impact it has, as well as the tactical considerations that go into conducting that campaign. I think that's especially the case in the context of this campaign and how this campaign has been structured. Because without going too much into the details of how that system works, which I think it will be addressed in another conversation, the story that you're going on through that campaign, you're not making decisions about winning or losing the war. The events of canon remain, by default, milestones in your campaign. Your character is in between those moments of fixed continuity, making what difference they can, doing what they can to help, and being forever changed by the experience. And I think in that context, understanding what the psychological impact of this kind of conflict is even more important. And there's so many different aspects of that, some of which we got to explore in mission briefs and scenarios and roles and traits, like Alison was talking about earlier. But at its core, I wanted there to be some kind of system to reflect how characters were changed over time, how the effects of the ordeals they were going through left a lasting impact. And whilst that's something that Strange New Worlds, as you say, has explored, you know, I my main source of inspiration was, again, the source material of Discovery Season 1. At the time that Discovery Season 1 aired, and arguably still, it was the darkest, goriest, most serialized version of Star Trek that appeared on screen. It was definitely not afraid of shying away from the violent side of conflict, and for having arcs that plotted out from episode to episode, seeing the ongoing effect of that. So I wanted a system that was going to make things a bit harsher, a bit nastier, and make people feel the pain of that conflict rather than being able to approach it strictly from a strategic exercise, which felt for me more in the spirit of what Star Trek was about and how Star Trek prefers to engage with these themes. Briefly touching on what that looks like mechanically, the trauma system that I designed is closely aligned with the existing values and traits systems. It's a way of using the existing system in Star Trek Adventures of challenging your values in a way that's just a bit meaner, rather than it being something that you can choose to do in order to gain determination. When your values are being suppressed in times of war, it's something that is either you're having to pay with your own determination in order to not be affected by that, to accept complication, but not getting the point of determination that you'd usually expect of that, or getting the point of determination by challenging the value, but having the long-term ongoing conquest consequence of a scar, which is a permanent trait, which is much, much harder to get rid of than injuries, say. It's something which dealing with it is something that you then have to deal with in milestones. And at the same time I was developing the system, I also tweaked the milestone system. So there's a little bit more changes of characters over time. Again, to the, both reflecting the fact that the series is a bit more serialized and changes in characters over time occur more in Discovery Season 1 than in other seasons. But also reflecting the fact that there was a need to kind of balance out the fact that you're accruing these complications, which are going to be an ongoing problem. So for the sake of balance, giving you more ways to improve your character was useful as well. I'd like to very briefly touch on three things that the system isn't, because I think people might have expectations for the trauma system is going to be like, which would be useful to head off at the pass. The first thing to say is it's not the trauma system that people might be familiar with from the 2D20 SRD. I wanted to go with something that was very closely aligned with the value system, as I say, because that's how I saw it reflected in the source material. Values aren't a default part of the 2D20 SRD, so it didn't carry onto this. The second thing that I'll say is I wouldn't call it a sanity system. It's not about accruing mental illnesses or similar tropes that you sometimes see in RPGs. You know, in fiction and in reality, we see characters who can come through war and people as experience of war, and as a consequence of that trauma, they accrue. They might start experiencing anxiety attacks or flashbacks or disassociation. And you can, if your group is consenting, use this system as a springboard into that. But this isn't a system that's going to give you rules for anxiety attacks, right? How you deal with that at your table is between you and the other players. The conditions that you're accruing from scars, they can be psychological, they can be physical, they can also be reputational. They can be to do with how other people view your character, not necessarily a change that your character has experienced themselves. The third thing I'd say the system isn't is a corruption system. There is a mechanic whereby as you're accruing scars, if you accrue more scars than values, your character might become unplayable. But that is to reflect the way in which your values have diverged from the rest of your party, such that you're no longer going to have aligned values that is necessary for you to be a character in play. What we're not saying is that trauma makes you evil, right? So it's about designing a system that accommodates, and again, you know, people's experience of trauma can mean that they become harder or colder or angrier or vengeful. We see that in fiction. Sometimes that can occur in reality. If you're with a group of players who are enthusiastic about pursuing that kind of storyline, you can, but that is just one way in which you can interpret the system. It's not the default way by any means. So I hope that people will find it a flexible system.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I honestly, you know, as you were talking and said, if a character becomes unplayable, that might be unplayable in STA or the Klingon War campaign, but it doesn't mean you couldn't take that character into Captain's Log and continue their adventures of recovery until such time that they're fit to rejoin. I mean, we've done that in my group where we actually started Captain's Log and ended up making it an STA game. So that, you know, again, and we'll talk about this, I know, in some of the future breakdowns of this book about how this is still compatible with all the other game systems. And really, we're just adding a rich tapestry of options to tell these stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael, that made me think of the conversation we had recently where we were trying to rehabilitate Kai Winn and Gul Dukat, right? If you take those two characters, load them up with scars, right? And now they are, you know, unplayable in the game context. We'll now, you know, move into Captain's Log and play through it. How do they recover? How do they change things out? Or can they? You know, some people can't, and that's just the unfortunate reality. But some people are able to get the help and the therapy they need to start healing and to start recovering. And then you come out a new. I mean, you're not back to where you were. You never go back. You only go forward in something new. So, no, I think this is a great system, and I think it just is a worthy addition to the game line because it just adds more nuance and more depth to the storytelling possibilities that you have. And I can't wait to see what gamers do with this once they get it in their hands and start adding it to their campaigns.
Yeah, and like Michael Duxbury said when he was explaining it, you know, make sure that there's consent at your table, right? And I think that we're all on board with doing that. There are safety tools in here. We'll talk about that more when we get into the GM section and whatnot. So yeah, it's such a cool system. I can't wait to see what comes out of it. Does anybody else have anything to add on the trauma system? Allison, John? I think that's going to take us to the end of chapter one.
Actually, what I was about to say, sorry, I was trying to mess with my mute button, is that I really like the trauma system for all the reasons everybody's covered. And one of the things I think players really should be prepared for is that this isn't a game, or this isn't like rule set to ruin your character. It's really to actually bring out something that important that happened to them. And not everybody's experience of war is going to be the same way. And I really like how the rules encourage both things. You could be like the hero who made it through the conflict and you're better for it. Your career is opening up. Maybe you're getting command of a starship. Maybe you were just a guy who was back at the fleet base who, you know, served lunch every day. Or maybe you were one of the grunts who served on the front line. Strange New Worlds showed us how like even a nurse got drawn into an intense heavy combat. And I think the rules, like after I read through them, they're so good at just letting you decide what's going to happen to your character and give you the framework that it's not just an arbitrary, I'm the best general, everything I do is great, I killed Klingons by the thousands, I'm so cool. It's more like, oh, let's take a chance. Let's see what happens to my character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Expert.
Sorry, I was just going to say, as you say, there are ways that you can resist accruing scars over the course of the game. But the point is to make it hurt, to make it hard. It's hard to be a good person when you're on the front line of a war. It should be something that is costly and painful, no matter what approach you're taking. So, yeah, you're right that there's multiple ways that players can engage in the system. But I'm hoping that it is going to produce interesting mechanical consideration and, most importantly, interesting story, no matter which approach they take. And it leaves room for players to go in interesting directions, and that introduces a bit of conflict and drama within the group. Again, very much reflected in the source material, which can be a fantastic thing to experience at the table, so long as everyone is consenting and enthusiastic about doing so.
Yeah. Talking about the source material, so much of the best episodes of Star Trek, the stories involve and revolve around characters being challenged by their own experiences of trauma. So really, we just want to give the players the opportunities and the tools to explore those kind of stories themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Duxbury, I had a question for you, actually, now that we're talking about this. And literally, I'm working my way through a rewatch of Voyager right now. I'm just getting into the first season. I'm curious, what do you think about using this subsystem to represent trauma that's not even related to a war, right? Like, and for context, I literally just watched Phage yesterday. And Phage is like, this entire species has this horrible disease that is destroying their flesh at a genetic level. And this entire culture has been forced to go harvest, you know, body parts from other people just so they can survive, right? And Janeway, when she learns all of this, is like, oh my gosh, like, how do I make this moral choice between, but like, I can see where you could use this system, even though they weren't at war. They were just, you know, they're just, this is a culture that has experienced significant trauma. Like, what would be your advice for people to use this and adapt it in a way that you could use it, but not even be in a wartime type of story?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pain everywhere in Star Trek, isn't there? Yeah. I know it's a lighter kind of science fiction, and it's a utopian setting.
Had his lungs stolen.
Yeah. I mean, Kirk has some awful things happening when he's a kid, you know, watching everyone starve to death around him. He has to watch his kid get killed by Klingons, and you see a lot of those scars carrying on into movies like The Undiscovered Country. Yeah, there's loads of examples throughout the setting where I think this kind of system could be a really interesting thing to implement. I will say that it is specifically designed to make the experience tougher. It's kind of like playing on hard mode in a way. So if you and I think that is absolutely expected for something like a wartime campaign, people expect to be put through the meat grinder in that situation. If you're adapting it outside a wartime setting, it's absolutely applicable. You'll definitely be able to use that system and be able to produce all the interesting role play that we've just been talking about. But just be warned that it's a bit more of an uphill battle to try and like make your way through when you're burdened by these additional complications and much harder to find the determination that you need in order to keep going and succeed at tasks.
Go ahead, John.
We see that also in like Enterprise. Like it's not even always about whether you're going to kill someone or you just like hate someone. Archer in season 3 makes the choice to engage in an open act of piracy, where he steals a ship's warp core. Now, he's doing it to save Earth and the human species, but you can see where the conflict, and it was a Zindi war pretty much with Earth. And you just see how he justified it in a very cold way, where it's like, no, we have to save Earth. They're not giving us their warp core, and it's okay. Here's a mod so they can go home at like warp 1. It'll take them months, but they'll be okay. And it's interesting how in Star Trek, you just see good upstanding characters, especially in conflict, just how things make them just do things that I know people argue about this all the time. I wouldn't say it's monstrous depending on your point of view with Archer, depending on like because yeah, that crew probably made it home okay, but he still stole their warp core.
Yeah. So I just want to point out two more and then I'll send it off to Michael and we can start move on to gratitude. Sisko absolutely had scars from one battle, right? It wasn't even a war. It was one battle. And Liam Shaw, right? That's a very current, relevant character who had clearly had some scars, from that and kind of like turned it around into a positive thing. So, this trauma system, I think, is spectacular. And I can't wait to hear the stories that come from it. So, end of chapter one, Michael.
It's amazing. And I'll add one more other character that's very scarred and people overlook oftentimes is Seven of Nine, coming out of being the conqueror, you know, being the assimilators, and then coming out and having to face that. I mean, look at how it's developed that character to this day. And if I had to go back and redesign Jim a character pack, I would be including, you know, with Seven, I'd be including some of this in there. Because we know it's something that she thinks about every single episode, it seems like. Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Fantastic. Well, so much gratitude to give. We'll go around. I'll go ahead and get it started. My gratitude in this case is to the rule developers on this. So this would be Allison and Al, right? Who I know Al and I have talked about this before. What a challenge when we're said to either create a solo RPG or in this case, a war campaign and come up with something that's engaging and interesting. I'm not even going to go. I'm waiting until we get into the future chapter about the actual game mechanics to talk about my experiences with it because I'm so excited. But blew it out of the water with this one. And also John, Michael, some of the other contributors that we'll be having as we go over the other chapters, just blew it out of the water. Just when I think that we've explored everything we can in the Star Trek universe, more world building tools. So really appreciate that from all of you. And with that, let's pass it over to Allison.
Help. yes. Oh goodness. I love the player options. I love the new like availability for what to do with the weapons, because those are tools that you can build a story around. And I love how your trauma system, Michael, just facilitates that so nicely.
Do I
pass along, or can someone else pass along?
Well, we're doing our gratitude, so let's keep going with the gratitude. Let's go Michael, John, Al, and Jim. That's how we'll do it. Yeah.
I mentioned earlier how grateful I was to be building on the work that other people did in this book. It's been one of the most collaborative RPG supplements that I've worked on, in terms of there was a great stage up front of being able to pitch ideas that we thought should be in the book and then produce something out of that. That was a wonderful experience to work on for this book. More generally, you know, beyond the scope of this book, other things that I'm grateful for at the moment. I mentioned up top that I'm doing my Kickstarter for Me, the Singularity RPG. I was inspired to do that by lots of other folks who are doing Kickstarters for Zine Month right now. And the fact that we all made that jump together was really inspiring me to step out there and give that a go. And that's something I've been very grateful for recently. So thank you to WH Arthur, who's currently doing their Kickstarter for Conviction, to Mikhail Malkin doing their Kickstarter for Fishbone Archipelago Lost Lighthouse, and everyone else that I've been interacting with through the UK Tabletop Industry Network for encouraging me to give that a go. That's been something I've been really grateful for recently.
Off to John, Alvin, Jim.
Really, I think it's just all of the rules that involve just how the characters grow. Like, Michael's rules were just so good. And it's really nice actually seeing how the engine can be pushed to tackle difficult subjects. And I know there's going to be a lot of people who they really just want to sit down to play Trek, and they want to do, like, you know, the four-color superhero approach, where, you know, the Saturday morning cartoon, we're here to fight evil, we're going to stop those Dominion and save the planet, we're going to do everything. And I know there's always like a fear that whenever rules like this are introduced, that we're going to turn it into essentially Call of Cthulhu, where it's like, oh, I made this really cool engineer, and now he's agoraphobic. He doesn't want to go anywhere. And it's like, no, these rules actually will encourage you to think about like how your character wants to change, but also provide you with a framework so that it's not just, you know, like it encourages you to take risks. And it's a really great way to just sit down and play the game and to see how your character will improve. And I think with shows like Strange New Worlds, we're seeing how Trek as a whole is trying to address things like PTSD, especially among veterans. And that's a very sensitive topic. And I've been very pleased so far. I know it's not always been perfect. I mean, not all of us become super soldiers thanks to an injection, and that makes us take out the enemy general. But it's really nice to be able to see Trek attempt to try to do the right thing and actually explore these themes. And I really like how the system is like it's shaped up to deliver that.
So my gratitude this week has to go out to Jim Johnson for giving me the opportunity to be the lead writer on this project. It was something that when he presented it, I was like super drawn to. I'm excited. I got to work with so many fantastic people. I mean, we had a huge crew on this project. And I think that what we've delivered is something that will span multiple centuries, multiple timelines, multiple games. So Jim, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Al. And so my gratitude is right back at you. I am grateful to Al and Ivan Sorensen, who both did some of the origination on the tactical component of the game that we'll talk about in a future episode. But Al, when I needed help, I reached out. And I knew you had it in you, just like I knew Michael had it in him to take the lead on Captain's Log. And as a project manager, you know, in modesty aside, like, I love it when I'm right. I love it when it works. When it works, it's great, because then I can say, oh, you guys did a fantastic job. The team you put together, and the writing that you all did, this stuff is so good. And not only is it like interesting wartime stuff, but it's Star Trek, right? Like, you can see the Star Trek woven in and out of it. So it's not just some generic thing that we've tacked on to the game system and said, yep, here you go. Here's your wartime rules. Here's your trauma rules. You're off and running. It's infused with Star Trek. And I mean, gosh, you mentioned this earlier, but what a happy coincidence that Strange New Worlds season 2 came out and like half their episodes focused directly on the trauma of the war impacting both Chapel and Mbanga, right? Like, where did that come from? Who saw that coming? And it's just amazing that it just fits in so nicely. So, but then, I mean, I was reading your drafts and I was totally thinking about Nog throughout all of this. Like, he is the singular character that I can think of in the Dominion War where we got to see his entire path of his beginning and his trauma and how it all came together. So, like, you guys did a fantastic job on this, and I am so proud of you all, and I'm so excited to add this to the Star Trek Adventures canon, such as it is. Bottom line, it's another big pile of tools that players and game masters can now look at and go, oh shoot, I just went to Home Depot and I bought another, 800 piece, socket set, and now I'm adding that to my toolkit. Now look at all the new stuff I can do with it. Or even like, I'm a big Lego fan, right? So it's like buying a new Lego set and having all these new pieces. And it's like, oh, I can take all this stuff and add it to what I've already got and make even more amazing things with my players. So again, grateful to all of you for everything that you did on this book. So proud of you all. Shout out to Ariel Orea for the fantastic artwork. We'll talk about artwork in future episodes as well. So thank you all. And of course, thank you to the fans. Without the fans, we wouldn't be doing this. After 8 years, right? This game wouldn't be around anymore. So thank you to the fans for supporting us, and especially for supporting each other and for supporting new fans. Like, we get new fans every day into this game, and they come onto the social media and onto the forums and stuff. And the fans are supporting each other and helping each other out. So clearly healthy game line, healthy game community, grateful to be part of it. So thank you all. Yep.
And Al, I hope you don't regret, taking the lead on this book, because I'm already planning 2 seasons ahead on our game to really use these rules. So it's all your fault. Everything that comes, all your fault. All right. So with that, the conversation continues. This is Chapter 1. Join us next week when we dive into the Easter eggs and goodies that are in Chapter 2 as we review the Klingon Federation War campaign. Until next time, IDIC.
Live long and prosper. Be safe, be well, and we'll talk to you all next time. We'll